OPN Ask an Angel podcasts are conversations with global angel investors and venture capitalists. We explore how to invest, understanding investment strategies and approaches to due diligence. Join us and learn what it takes to be a startup or what it takes to invest in the next great company.
Welcome to the Supporters Fund Ask an Investor. I'm your host, Jeffrey Potvin, and let's please welcome Saad Hassan from Hassan Family Office, CEO of Investive, as our investor for today. Welcome, Saad. It's a real pleasure having you join us today.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. Well, I'm excited to chat with you because we've chatted over the years. You've built out something new that's pretty exciting. I think we first met at, it was at a pitch event, and it was through Founders Institute. Yeah, and I've always been a big fan of being able to jump in and help out when they have companies go through. And I think we both hit it off pretty quickly because of the space that you were tackling and jumping into. So I was pretty excited to chat with you, and we've continued that conversation over the years. So I'm excited to jump in. And the way we like to kick off our show is that we want to learn a bit more about yourself. So you go back all the way to your Western days, TD, give us some background on yourself, a little bit about what you do, and then one thing about you that nobody would know.
Interesting. Okay. So I went to Waterloo, Northwestern. I'm very proud of that fact. I would actually go even further back. So our family is originally from Bangladesh, a little bit of roots in the Middle East as well. But we moved here when I was 9 years old. Waterloo was 2008, I think, when I started in Waterloo, and I actually did health sciences. That's something that a lot of people don't know about me, given my industry, but my plan was to go through med school and become a doctor. My mom is a pediatrician. So, and when I was 4 years old, I broke my hand, got two elbow surgeries, and spent the next 2 years, no, 3 years doing therapy and all of those things at the hospital ward with my mother and her department. And I basically, it was after school all the way until, you know, nighttime when she would come home. So I got to really understand and know the hospital scene. So from a very young age, I had been ingrained with the fact that I want to be in this space. This is what I want to do with my life. So, you know, fast forward through high school, an IB program here in Toronto, got into Waterloo for health sciences. In my third year, I did my MCATs, you know, got into some Caribbean schools. I wasn't good enough to get into the Canadian schools. And then I had just this decision to make. And I thought to myself, okay, I spend a couple of $100,000, go to med school, spend the next, you know, 7-8 years of my life in school just to be a GP. Maybe if I want to specialize, that's more school. All to, you know, then work in a hospital and some sort of clinic in a depressing environment, staring at, you know, gray walls for 16 hours a day. Or I make a decision now and just make a change, go towards something that I'm more interested in. And so that's where I made that little switch and went into to business. People have always told me, I've always been very good at science. My thinking has always been science. And even in business, the way that I thought my think and process information has been through sort of scientific method. But people always tell me that I'm much better with people than I am with you know, inanimate things. So, you know, it always worked out. So I did business in Waterloo. I finished up the program in UOIT, which is now University of Ontario. And then I worked at TD for a little while I was going through the last aspect of school. Started out, you know, doing very simple basic analyst stuff in TD, then went into TD Securities, went into the over-the-counter trades department, did some investment banking. That's when I got into private investments. And all through this time, you know, my family office, it's a single family office. I had completely opted to stay away from the family office. Most of the family has been managed by, you know, outsourced wealth managers and et cetera. I hadn't touched that altogether at all. And I had made it a point to myself that I was going to make it on my own and not try to, you know, take advantage of the situation that I had. So it was required of me to gain my own credentials. It was required of me to make it my own way. And only when I was able to really prove my worth, then I slowly started moving into handling some work for the family office. Now, my area of expertise has always been private investments. Public markets has never really been something that I've been very good at. And so private investments, I understand it. I get to roll up my sleeves. I get to sort of put my thinking cap on. And I think that's what's interesting. So as I made more relationships and as I did more deals in the private space, I was able to start taking some of our family's allocations and start to put it into private investments. So that's really how I got into it. Now we're at a situation where I manage the private arm of the family office. The public arm is still, you know, outsourced, but mostly what I spend my days doing, I wear a couple of hats, but on the family office side, I spend most of my time doing research and DD and allocations for real estate, for private equity, for venture, often for infrastructure deals, which is along the lines of what we do. And, you know, then along the way we created Investive. And so I spent a lot of my time doing that as well. And we can talk about that a little bit as well. So yeah, that's a little bit about me to answer your question about something that most people don't know about me. I was almost a doctor.
I love it. And that's a really exciting background. I love the idea that you actually at one point decided I have to make a call here and make a change. And I think that's crucial in any youth's life is to see the picture ahead of them and figure out if this is the picture they want to be part of.
Yeah, that's I mean, you can imagine how that went. You can imagine how that went in the family, you know, a family, you know, Brown family, mother is a doctor and the father is an engineer. And so you tell them, hey, I'm going to quit sciences and I'm going to go into business. That was lovely for them.
Well, I'm sure it was a little bit of a turning point, but as you mentioned, they weren't going to just hand over the keys to the car. They were waiting for you to kind of prove yourself, and you still had to go through that change, which I think is also shows that, you know, they supported you and they cared about you, but they wanted you to pave the way. So if you're going to make the pivot, you got to have to make that way to direction of what's going to bring value back, not only to you, but to the family.
Yeah, for sure.
So you mentioned, and I'd love to learn a bit more about it, and you can share on the Investive side. So while you were going through this journey, and I would say it's more of a background side, because as you mentioned, you weren't doing a lot of the family side, but you started to dive into it. And then you came up with your own model and how you wanted to start investing in venture and working with early stage companies. And I remember a few years back, you actually connected us to a company that we ended up investing in. And so you understand the space, you work inside of it. Maybe you can share a little bit more about how that looks today and where Investive is and where you're looking to go with it.
Yeah, sure. So Investive is just a private alternative investments ecosystem. We started out as a matchmaking service, but we realized very quickly that the main pain point that we have to solve in this industry is that there's a lack of technology that connects private investments. Right, it is a very siloed space. People value, you know, relationships and transactions more so than efficiency and streamlining using technology, for a good reason, because, you know, as you become more and more wealthy as a family, the more you're out to protect yourself in your name and not be involved and known for your activities, makes you a target, but also at the same time, it makes you a source for solicitations or target for solicitations. So people don't really like that very much. So privacy is low key. A lot of people have come and tried to do what we're doing, but they haven't really solved the privacy issue. So that being our North Star, we've built Investive to be an infrastructure and technology that prioritizes the privacy of our investors, does not share their information to just anybody, you know, not be some sort of a database that you can just go on and just search for investors and call on them. But mainly focus on building tech that we know will streamline and facilitate the investment process. That includes, you know, data rooms, because that's a huge aspect. That includes reports that relate to due diligence between the investor and the manager, and the investor relations portion, which, you know, buffers the initial introductions all the way to the point of that deal closing. So we know that we'll never replace the need for an in-person meeting, the need to look into somebody's eye and shake their hand. But we understand that prior to that, there's a lot of due diligence that can be done that disqualifies a lot of potentials even after they meet. So it's really about reducing the cost of business development on both sides. It started out because we were in co-investing with a lot of family offices. There was about 20 family offices that we were doing deals with. Given that I was younger, given that I had a sort of hunger for technology, they just looked at me and they said, look, why don't you build us an intake portal? The problem that we were trying to solve is that, you know, as known investors, we're pitched all the time. And usually the pitches look the same way, right? It's, hi, here's a blurb, comes in on LinkedIn or email, a long blurb about who they are attached with a presentation. Now, for them to really go through all that, they have to dedicate a lot of analyst resources to qualify that deal. Not always worth it, but they understand that there's some diamond in the rough. And investors, you'll realize that they come with a lot of FOMO, right? So to solve that problem, they said, okay, let's build an intake portal where we create an account, we set our specific criteria ahead of time, set it, forget it. And anytime somebody pitches us or calls us, we say, hold on, you know, stop right there. Go onto this website, fill out the forms there, and there's a layered algorithm that'll tell us if we should talk to you or not. It was just a simple website. So, you know, it was very useful for us. So the 20 family offices started, you know, sharing it with other family offices who then started diverting more of their solicitors onto the system. And eventually one day we woke up and there were a lot of people on one side and there was a lot of people on the other side. And we thought, hey, there's a marketplace. So we spun it off into its own business. So that was the genesis of Investive, keeping everybody's identities private, understanding the set prerequisites ahead of time, making matches based off an algorithm that, you know, told you as an investor, should you or should you not speak to this person based on an algorithm that we've chosen. We've then, you know, moved away from just that aspect. Then we started realizing, okay, well, the matchmaking is an important component. But then they started telling us, hey, we have an issue with the way information is being relayed to us, right? Data rooms that are coming to us sometimes are incomplete, sometimes they're inconsistent, files are mislabeled. So we never know, you know, where to look for what. So can you then now standardize data rooms? So we've built a system that standardizes the way delivery of data rooms is done completely in a structured manner. Almost like what a DocSend does, the features of a DocSend, except it's not just drag and drop files, it's drag and drop files into its known containers so that you're able to then, you know, render it in a nice way that everybody knows. And every time an investor gets a proposal from us, from a client, it looks the exact same way every single time. So that's really what Investive is. And I think that in the next couple of years, we really anticipate that Investive will be the central go-to place for anybody looking to find private alternative investments.
That's awesome. And just before we dive into everything else, I'm going to say that I'm not sure if you've been back to Bangladesh in a while, but I spent probably almost a month in Dhaka and surrounding area, and a huge fan. Honestly, it's a fantastic country, beautiful people. Landscape's beautiful. It is got the hustle there, which is fantastic. They were just launching the train, a new metro through Dhaka when I was there.
Yeah.
And I was trying to take the train into Kolkata, but it was, I couldn't get on. But there was some great people that were helping me along the way. And I didn't even ask, like, this is the best part, just in the train station, trying to figure out why I couldn't get onto one of the many, many trains that go in and out of India. And this young guy comes up, probably saw that I looked a little bit perplexed at the antiquated system, and jumped in and started asking. He's like, this guy's a foreigner, get this guy on his train. And he did everything to get me through. And it was honestly, it was a beautiful experience. I just thought I'd share that, but fantastic country.
Well, I'll say this, and not just Bangladesh, in most places in the world, if you've been to places where there is struggle, and there is a lot of struggle in Bangladesh, I think struggle makes for simple people, and simple people come with really big hearts. And I have noticed that in not just in Bangladesh, but in a lot of places in the world.
100% agree with that. Like Sri Lanka, same thing. Amazing people going through some tough times. I was there just before the uprising that happened. And it was the same. People just phenomenal because they're working together to build and move forward. Yeah. And all the other things are just obstacles in that journey. So, but again, beautiful, beautiful places.
You would think that's not the case because, you know, when you have scarcity like that, you know, theory tells you that people tend to become selfish, but, you know, that's not the case. I think that, they go back to their roots of being herd animals and being herd mammals as nature. And I think you realize that the pack survives, and I think they have that mentality.
Completely agree with you. Yeah, it's pretty cool to be part of, and I can say that it was like being in rural China when a decade ago when my photo was taken more than I took. So when I was in Bangladesh, there's very few foreigners that go there. I think I had my photo taken more than I took of the great architecture and old cities and villages I was in. So it's pretty cool.
You're probably, you know, on some shelves right now in Bangladesh just saying, hey, I met a white guy one time.
Oh, totally. And I will say that they have phenomenal food. The food is phenomenal. Street food, awesome. And all of that carried over into Kolkata, into India. Yeah. So you had West Bengalese food there. Oh, man. Like I could put on 100 pounds just hanging out there. Like it was incredible.
That is true.
So, well, I diverted, but so let's go back a little bit into, to kind of pick into some of this great story and the line that you've gone on. You had some great experience, of course, being able to kind of work at your mother's work. And I think that's really kind of cool because they have these environments set up, I guess, all over the world where you have that opportunity to go to your parents' work and spend a day or two there. You spent a month or two there kind of rehabilitating. So you really got to learn that. Oh, years, even better.
Years, yeah.
So you became one of kind of the, you were almost like an intern doctor as a young kid, just learning and working through the system. So it's pretty exciting learnings that you gained from that on process, abilities to what things you could do, interacting with people, because you would have had so many people interacting with the young guy that was hanging out with his mom for months and years. That's pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah. Everything that I am today, I think, is derived from the lessons learned from then, because that inspired me to want to pursue sciences, which I have zero regrets. Even though I moved away from sciences, I think that the lessons that I learned in how to process information and apply things, I may not know a lot of things, but, you know, and I consider myself not a master of anything, but really a jack of all trades. But what I think I can really do well is to take information from one thing, apply it to another, and find connections between the two, which I think really comes from the scientific background. So 100%, I think that really has been the biggest source of sort of motivation and drive in my life.
Well, hopefully this motivates other people to say, maybe I should be bringing my kids into the office or into my work environment a little bit more, so they do gain that intrinsic knowledge that's just gained through socializing and communicating just in the environment you're in. I think we lose that ability to think there's anything there, but just being able to observe that, the red alerts going on, all of these things create actions, and you see how people move and interact and do things. You learn from that, especially when it's repetitive every day. And then you take that and move that along into your environment when you got into TD Securities and started to work your way into the corporate side. Is there a couple of things that you could say you learned as well in the corporate infrastructure that have helped you today in the entrepreneurial side?
Yeah. I had this really great director who kind of saw something in me and took me under his wing. And I have to say, you know, I owe a lot to him in how he did it, because he understood something about me, which is, you know, people have different learning styles, you know, different personalities and all of those things. And I think he did a test on every one of his employees. And I found this very unique, and I do this in my companies too. First thing he always did was he checked what our learning styles are and what our motivational styles are. And then the other thing that he gave us a survey on is he said, you know, when you are recognized for the work that you do, do you prefer to be recognized in public or do you prefer to be recognized in private? I found that fascinating, and I found that it was great management. But what he learned about me is that I like to be recognized in private. I get awkward in public acknowledgments, but also at the same time, what he recognized about me is that I'm the type of person where if I'm to be convinced to do something or motivated to do something, I can't just be told what or how to do it. I need to be told why. And if I understand it and if I can understand your why, then I will take ownership of the situation and I will work on it just the same way that, you know, I was the owner of that business. And he really taught me through my corporate journey that, hey, if you want to do well in anything, you have to treat it like it's your own business. It may not be, but that level of ownership that you take will dictate your initiative and it'll dictate everything else that you do and your accomplishments along the way. So I think I had a really good role model early on who kind of crafted me in the right direction. And I think that that's what sort of propelled me throughout the journey that I had at TD.
I love that. And the part that I love, there's a couple of things that you stated there, but treat it like it's your own business. If you want to get something out of something, you really have to treat it like it's your own. Put the passion, the drive, that will align everybody else up to support you at the same time. So I think that's super valuable. But I think the real top line value here that you gained was that someone saw something in you through the test or through just being able to meet with you and interact with you, and they took you under their wing. I think this is something 100%. That I find that is lacking in the world today, or even in general, is that people don't take enough time to learn the people that are with them and then figure out how can they actually prop them up and help them positively. Like there's going to be some things where you got to give people a nudge and a push and a punch just to kind of get things rolling. But really that positive reinforcement of understanding who you are and how you work. And I love that they go into recognizing these pieces so that that actually enabled you to be better, which also enables you then to take accountability to want to treat it like your business because you had somebody that actually was looking after you, you know, as an umbrella, as you want to call it. But that is pretty exciting. I would think that that is such a valuable thing that so many people probably lack today, and that you were able to find that. I think that's amazing.
100%. I saw it within, you know, my department itself. A lot of people didn't get that type of treatment. I don't know what it was about me that made him, you know, do this, but I think he recognized early on. And this is also something that he taught me. And he said, look, you will eventually get into management positions in your life. And the one thing that people don't understand, and I take this into sort of business as well. So with all my businesses, when you start, you are the founder. You are the one who has to do everything. Same with a job like a TD, you're the analyst, you have to do everything. But suddenly you, for your performance and your excellence, you get promoted into becoming a manager responsible for people. I think that's a kind of a broken system. And I think it was Simon Sinek that talks about this as well, where there's a bit of a broken system where, you know, you take the best doers and you make them leaders, but that doesn't make you a good leader because you know how to do the job, but that's no longer your job. You ask most leaders what your responsibility is, and it's no longer to run the business, it's to manage the people that run the business. So I think what he taught me early on was how to manage people and how people want to be managed by leading by example. And so when I went into management for TD and a few other companies, I think I was able to carry on what he taught me sort of, you know, informally. And I think that's really contributed to success in my businesses because, you know, I've never raised capital for any of my businesses, bootstrapped it all the way through. And that comes with being able to inspire people to believe in you along the way without getting paid. And I think that that only comes from being able to understand what motivates them, how they want to be managed, how they want to be treated, and how they want to feel that they have ownership into the enterprise that you're building together.
And that goes to the point you just mentioned again, where it goes to how to motivate people. Are there a couple of things that you can share on how you motivate your team, how you motivate? And I know I've sat down with you a few times. I leave excited because just how you interact with people, the things that you're sharing, it gets you excited because you're not talking today, you're talking vision. So vision is a big player in that. But how do you motivate your teams? How did you do it then? And then how are you doing it today? And what is that thing that just the golden nugget that every founder needs to know? Because they're like, I can't motivate 100 people. How do I do this? I need help.
You have to be very, very transparent. I get yelled at about this all the time because even now when we've gotten a little bigger, I tend to be very transparent with everybody about how things are doing, so whether it's revenue, whether it's you know, operations that are, you know, in the works and et cetera. You know, I don't believe in siloing departments because then it leaves them confused as to, you know, what their roles are. I really like the idea of dynamic teams that are cross-functional because it lets everybody have an understanding of all the things that are happening and how the puzzle pieces fit together. And I think that when people have that, they start to feel like they, again, have ownership into the position, and they're not just some, you know, cog along the way, that they're seeing the whole grand vision.
So you're creating a value system for each individual in the business so they feel that they're being rewarded by being able to work with other sharp resources that are in the business. Yeah. They're being rewarded by your direction. They're being rewarded by all of these different things that all sum up to allow them to see that there's a bigger future in this role than just being this specific role.
Yeah. And also the other thing is to being able to really carefully tread the line between professional and friendship. When you start a business and you're closely working with everybody, you know, it has to be a very close relationship. You need to feel like it's a brotherhood or a family. But then, you know, you also have to toe the line of keeping it professional, right? Keeping sort of the lines very clear. And sometimes I fail at that. Sometimes I'm good at it. But I think that if we can master that, then it becomes a good motivator for people as well.
So does that kind of go into the lines of accountability? You're allowing everybody to create their own accountability, but that's where that line is. If there's no accountability, then you're just buddies working together. If there's accountability, then you're kind of that business structure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love
I'm a little different. I mean, some people feel differently, but I don't like mixing friends and family into business at all. Some people, you know, completely think the other way, especially in my culture. You know, it's like, well, nepotism is a good thing. Because those are the only people that you can ideally trust. But I feel differently because I feel that the more nepotism you show, the less you can keep people accountable. And so I don't per se bring friends from outside into my business or family, but it does happen that as I bring people into the business, they tend to become very close to us. They tend to become family. And then you kind of have to know where that line is to say, okay, great, we're here, but let's stop here.
Well, and I think that carries into with the nepotism side is that there's a lot of emotion that gets drawn into it. So you lose the accountability sometimes because you can say, wait, I'm the family. Why are you yelling at me? Or why are you putting this deadline on me? I'm your brother. Yeah. So I guess those things can change because there's that fine line of what side do you play? But this is fascinating because now this shifts into the other business that you operate in, which you managed over the, I think it's been the last 5 years now that you've been really running all of this, which is the family office. So family office, it says it right there, family office. It's not one person and then you've got all these people that work for you and not one person is in the family. So you've actually had to kind of figure out, okay, well, how can I run this business effectively and efficiently while managing the emotional connection of the family inside of this ownership, while still trying to hit the goals and aspirations of the entirety of what we're trying to achieve. And I'm guessing that there's got to be some line crossing and some calls to mom and dad and saying, I'm not understanding this right now, but how do I get through this? So how do you kind of juggle through that emotional side? Not the nepotism, I think that's innate in what you're doing, but how do you manage the emotion side to still hit your goals?
Well, one of the biggest issues with a family office is the infighting that happens, right? So a first generation, so here's what happens. The first generation that makes the money is the tough one who is less emotion and more logic, more here's how I made the money because I'm tough. The kids are a little more sheltered, but they're still there. The third generation becomes a little crazy. And the fourth generation, if the family is lucky enough to make it there, tends to squander your money entirely, if not the third generation. That's been the case with most family offices. So the biggest two factors that affect the family office are family members who want either ownership or employment within the family office itself. That always comes with infighting. The other aspect of a family office is that how is the money allocated within the family members? Can they have access to those resources? Do you know how are the trusts set up and all of those things? And I think that we did it pretty badly until I came in and just sort of changed a few things around. So in terms of employment within the family office, I'm lucky because none of my family members, the cousins, anybody are really in the finance field. They're all doctors and engineers and lawyers and stuff like that. So, you know, for them, they have no real interest as long as they have, you know, some access to the funds. Now, on the other side of the equation, that's when things get a little hairy. It wasn't set up very well. It was set up in a very, you know, typical, you know, in the Middle East and in Asia, you don't really have the trust system. It's more like, okay, well, here's the money when you want it. We set it up a little differently. You know the story of the Vanderbilts and the Rothschilds and how their families are set up? So Vanderbilts lost their money because they created trust fund babies, right? With the Rothschilds, they have the family bank set up, and that's what we did. So, you know, it's our opinion that, you know, what pulls you ahead in life is not having free money, it's having access to capital. And, you know, the way we set it up is that if somebody within the family has a need for the capital or a need for a business venture or whatever, we'll give it to them by a committee, you know, as a vote in terms of a loan. You know, it's going to be a loan at 0% for whatever they need. They'll need to submit a business proposal. We'll need to evaluate it all. And as a committee, we decide yes or no. The first time is always usually a yes. You know what? You have access to the capital, prove yourself. If you squander that money and you don't respect what that money means, then you don't get it again. But, you know, it's like what Trump said, right? Like, you know, my dad gave me a measly $1 million loan. So for us, it's similar to that. You know, if you take a loan, you know, do something with it. And if you squander it, then that's a very cheap lesson for us to know that not to give you money again. And that generally keeps a good system.
I love that setup. And the part that I like the most about what you just talked about is that you're using history of how others have done things. Again, where I find that there's the lack of people going and researching what the Rothschilds did or this group did. When you learn what they've done and where their shortcomings were and where they had the wins, and you take that back and kind of break it down and say, okay, this is what we want to be today, and baby steps will get us to this next level. And you were able to take that and say, okay, we've got the history, what you've already learned about what your family's done, and then took a census of what everybody else is doing and saying, look, this seems to be a better function for how we're going to operate. And then this is how we can go forward. And I love the fact that the first time you do something, we're going to invest in you. Why? Because your family, we believe in you. We're going to look at the proposal. We're going to give you feedback. We're going to help you along this journey, but make it worthwhile, because the second time it's going to be harder if you can't make the first time work. So it really does put you in the driver's seat. It gives you the confidence. And I think that is also something that lacks in the world, is that people make that first money the hardest money you ever get. And then when you try to work through it and you can't figure out ways to win, then you start doing the wrong things to gain back what you lost. And it just makes it even muddier and worse. In this case, you're already giving them the support. You're helping them along. And then when they do have problems, they're coming to you first. They're not going to come to you last. So again, that's just a different way of looking at the system, where it doesn't work like that in most institutions or anywhere else today. So I love that.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing is meritocracy, right? I mean, I have so much to say on the topic, but we are now in a society where meritocracy is not that important. I think that we need to preserve that, because that's how you squander everything. So if we are not creating an environment of accountability and, you know, paying and rewarding merit, then we're not going to create that culture going forward. So legacy is everything for us. I'm second generation, or I would say I'm third generation technically. But this is the first time that a member of our family is really taking, you know, ownership of the family's resources. So I think it's on me to sort of put it in a way that works. And we've had many advisors along the way that guided us in the right direction. But this is definitely not me on my own. But I think that some of my interest in history, as you said, helps along the way.
Agreed. And I think the other piece that really ties, and you just mentioned this, is that you had a lot of other input as well. And this input from these other groups, it tends to be self-serving, because they don't get paid if they're not doing this and you don't do this. So there's a fine balance of, are they doing this because they see the benefit in us being around a long time and next generation, or they try to clean our pockets out of all of our money so that we don't have this next generation. So there's a fine line that you're doing it for the family, they're doing it for themselves, but somewhere in between, there's going to be the fine line that allows you to operate and grow as a family office and continue to grow for generations.
Yeah. Well, one of the very unique advantages that I have, given the platform that I've built with Investive, is we have the trust of many family offices. And, you know, because I provide them a value and I don't charge them to work with us, they're always willing to reciprocate in other ways. And that includes, you know, understanding and insight into how they run their family office. That includes, you know, problems that they face and challenges that they face. Sometimes they talk to me about very personal issues around, you know, the habits of their children and all of those things. And I learn all of that, and I can say, okay, here's where I think there are some patterns evolving. Maybe I don't want to go in that direction. And that insight, I think, that I have is very unique and I'm very grateful for it.
Agreed. 100%. So in this journey of working in the family office and really learning this new format and how you want to operate, how you can build all these massive projects and start getting investment and driving them in, how do the outside parties, you said they kind of find you, they send you stuff and you decide, is this worth it? So let's just take this as a context of all family offices.
Sure.
As a startup founder, what's the best approach on how they should be approaching a family office? Because I think a lot of family offices operate in the prop tech space. They love properties. They want that quick return, 5 years tops. Yeah. I want in and out in 3 to 5. Yeah. And then they don't look at startups the same way. They're like, "Man, you're a startup. You could be dead into this for 10 years. I don't have 10 years. So what do you see as a family office in a way that a startup should actually approach, not just you guys, but family offices in general? What is the needs that they are trying to fill? And then how does a startup or a mid-tier company get those needs filled by them? Like, what is that cusp that really makes a difference?
Okay, I'll point out two things. I think that these are the two less obvious things. Everything else, I think, is quite obvious. You know, everyone talks about all the ways to invest or to pitch somebody. The number one thing you have to remember, especially with family offices, is that they are not an institution. They're people, right? Family offices, you know, if you treat an institution like a bank account, they don't mind because that's what they are. If you sometimes, even with VCs, as you know, they want to be treated like a bank account because they want to be treated in an institutional manner. Family offices are formal institutions, but they forget that because it's usually the principals or the patriarchs, et cetera, who are actually managing the money. Even if it's a CIO who's not part of the family, they still have some equity into that money. So they're investing their own capital. And there's a big difference in how you deal with those people. So, you know, you have to treat them like human beings. You have to understand what moves them, what drives them. And when you approach them and talk to them, don't just throw a project at them or don't just throw, you know, an idea at them. Try to build a relationship. And that's hard, I know, but it's important to do. And I think this is the second one that ties into it is, VCs, generally you go on a VC's website and you'll see their investment criteria. It tells you, this is the criteria that I invest in. Don't bother me if you don't fit into that criteria. Family offices are different. A lot of them are open to ideas. But you have to also think about where they're coming from. So here's a piece of insight. Look at how the family made their money, right? So if it's a family that made their money because of a startup or a business that they started, let's just say in mining or in natural resources, then they're the types of family that will keep investing in those categories. Because that's what they know and that's what they're aware of. But more importantly, they'll invest directly into those industries because they have the hands-on experience. Every family will need to diversify their portfolio, which means that they're still going to invest in other things, but they'll probably invest indirectly through a manager, through a VC, and et cetera. So if you know how a family made their money, then you know whether to approach them for a direct investment or not if you fall into the category that they invest into. A family that made their wealth in real estate is likely not going to invest directly in you because they probably don't know anything about running a startup. So they're going to go through VCs and then they might even direct you to the VC that they put their LP capital into. But to really understand that really separates you from, you know, the thousands of other founders who don't know anything about this one concept.
I love that. You're understanding your audience, but really doing your homework and figuring out, is this something that they would be interested in? Have they done this before? What's the pattern? What's the history? So again, it goes back to that history side and learning more about them. And again, I agree, this is something that is missed, or we're just running and gunning and don't take the time to actually look into it and say, wait a sec, I could save myself cycles if I actually did some research and learned more about this business or this family office.
Oh yeah, and we can always tell when it's a run and gun, spray and pray method. Right. Like, you know, if you send us a blurb on LinkedIn with, even if you use our names, we are aware that there are, you know, name tags that you can use from automation softwares. Right. So that's not the issue. It's just there's a billion of these coming in on a monthly, yearly basis, whatever. Right. So question is, which one do we address? It's the ones that really pull at our heartstrings, because at the end of the day, you have to remember that family offices do have a heartstring in there somewhere.
I like that one. What pulls at the heartstring? That's huge. And you got to find what that little nugget is. I remember sharing this with a founder where they said that it, investors are bad, venture don't understand anything, and they don't invest correctly. And I said, no, maybe it's a take the reverse of that. Maybe that the investor has built this box around what works, and you have to figure out how to get in that box. And this box is fortified, 20-foot walls. They have everything in there because they want to find out that how hard are you going to work to improve and impress on them that you're someone they should invest in, because they've had enough fails. And that's why the box gets smaller and smaller and the walls get higher and higher, because they're really honing in on what brings success. And that's what they know.
Well, especially in this climate, right? Everyone is so tight with their purse strings right now because everyone's holding and they're trying to stay liquid. But and so, you know, I keep hearing and seeing all over the news that, you know, investors are no longer investing. They're holding on. That's not what we've seen in our system. The nice thing about our system is that it's being changed live. So we can see shifting mandates. And what we've seen is that the amount of money that needs to be invested is still very constant. It's just the asset classes and the criteria have become now tighter. So people at the end of the day still need to invest their money, right? They still need to fight and combat inflation. They still need to grow their wealth at a faster rate than the money's losing value. So investments are still happening. It's just now understanding how an entity thinks based on the current climate and knowing where they've shifted their priorities, as opposed to thinking entirely that they're not investing. Now, if they don't have money, like dry powder, that's entirely different. But I'm talking about people who have the money. They will still invest. They're just looking for opportunistic types of deals pertaining to that climate.
I love it. If there's one thing that you would share that would make your pitch the most effective to a family office, what would that be? Is it, you mentioned lots of different things, of course, but is there something that, you know what, if you're in the prop tech space, just focus on prop tech investor family offices. Don't go after everybody. Don't save yourself the time. Or is it, make it enticing, or make it that it's a valuable project, raise a lot of money. Family offices don't want to invest $100,000. They want to invest $100 million. So don't go to them unless you've got a lot of money that you're looking for. Like, what is that nugget that changes the dynamic of when you want to involve a family office?
Family offices also are, things have changed. They're more than willing to write a $100,000 check into multiple startups, because I think the startup asset class has become a lot more popular, where they're going indirectly through VCs, because obviously there's a level of expertise there and access. But if deals come to them directly, they're not opposed to, you know, avoiding a layer of fees or something along the way. So, you know, they'll write checks, big or small. That's not the issue. The issue, I think, is really around knowing how they're going to invest. Startups need to understand that family offices are interested in vision. We have a lot of FOMO and we're very competitive, right? At the end of the day, you have to hearken back to human nature. One of my favorite books is Laws of Human Nature from Robert Greene. And you have to remember that there is a certain level of competition within family offices. They like to get together and they like to talk about their deals. They like to brag about what they've invested into, because there's not much else to talk about. They like to keep other aspects of their family offices quite secretive. So, you know, you want to sell them on the idea of the future. Everybody knows that your deal at the point that you're looking to raise capital is probably not that impressive. But most founders, I think, don't talk about the vision. I think they spend too much time talking about product. As a matter of fact, even the Y Combinator's standard pitch deck template, the 8 to 10 page template, really spends a lot of time talking about product, business model, and what the problem you're solving and all of those things. There's not a single slide in there that says, hey, talk about your vision. Talk about, where is this going to be in 5 years? How are you going to become insanely rich from this investment? I don't think that that's talked about enough. And I think that often what founders do is they leave it to the family to try to make it that determination on their own. And maybe that's a good thing, because sometimes some families will get it, but sometimes some families, they're going to say, look, if you don't spell it out for me, I don't want to have to do the work, right? So I would say spend half of your pitch talking about the vision, And once you've really clarified and crystallized the vision, then talk about your product, because nobody cares what your product is. They just want to know where you're going.
I'm hitting the red button, green button with the thumbs up. Like, that's awesome. Super valuable. Brilliant. I love to share that when founders pitch is that it should be 1 minute on the problem solution and 9 minutes or 6 minutes or 5 minutes on how do you make money? Yeah. That's all that matters. How do you make money? And then I'd add that layer in. What is your vision? I love that, because a lot of founders sometimes get stuck in the product and how to sell you on it because it's so crazy and difficult and technical that they don't actually think of the simplicity of it and what the outcome is. You know, I'm creating a car today, but it's going to be a flying ship in 5 years. Wow, that's sick. That's where you're going. That's what I want to know. That's huge. And that's so much value. Yeah. So I think what you're sharing there is keep looking, project forward, and just give them a taste of it. It doesn't have to be a 10-minute pitch on where you're going, but just something that gives them the goal of where this market's going and how you're going to lead it.
So let me add a caveat to that, though. So absolutely right. Talk about projections and don't be afraid to really project and aim for this, aim for the moon. But worst thing, you know, the one thing that makes us cringe is when a founder says this is $100 million or $100 billion market, and if we only took 1% of it, then this is how much money we would make. That's a big if, right? So whenever a founder says that, Tanish, to me, automatically my brain turns off. Instead of going through this top-down approach, whatever projections you make, make sure it's bottom-up. Make sure you take into account the potential customers that you're going to sell to, and really identify who they are, and then do the calculation from a bottom-up period. And when I see that a founder does that, or they tell me what their market size is, immediately I ask them how they got that number. And if they say that they got it from some article, I turn off right away. If they say that they've done it based on, okay, we've determined the number of potential customers, we looked at what our average customer spend is, and we've calculated it, that this is would be the annual spend expenditure. That to me is like, okay, I don't need to know anything else about you, but you have some realistic expectations.
That's great. Well, bottom up, I think we're going to start shifting now into a couple of our last segments. Man, everything you've shared is awesome. So valuable. Lots of great insights.
Well, you're a VC, so I'm glad you think so.
Yeah, this is great, man. All right. Toughest lesson you have learned as an investor?
You're going to lose money. You know, Warren Buffett has a quote that says, rule number one, never lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Yeah, that doesn't work. You're going to lose money, especially in startup investments. So you have to go in with the understanding that it's about the law of averages, right? Everyone is going to look wonderful, but we factor in that only a small portion of our investments are going to pan out. And hopefully their capital gains or your capital gains from that investment outweigh the losses. That's something that took me a hard time in the beginning. I was taking my losses personally. And outside of that, you know, investments. Oh, here's the other thing that I've learned. In the beginning, I was taking a lot of time making decisions. And I think a lot of families do this. But I think that you don't need time to make a decision. I think you need information to make a decision. And I wish that more families and more institutions, you know, understood that and adapted that. You can sit around and discuss something, but I think, you know, when they tell you when you're going through university, right, that if you're doing a multiple choice question, it's your first instinct that's usually the right answer. The more you overthink it, the more you try to, you know, second guess yourself. So I think that generally your instincts about an investment when you first, you know, evaluate it is correct. And I've learned to tend to do that more now, where I used to pretty much get cold feet before.
Well, you're trusting yourself. And I think that really makes a big difference. So you trust comes from losses. Trust comes from making mistakes. So I love that. That's great. Okay, now we're going to kind of shift a little bit into a case study. And maybe you have a startup founder, she or he, that you've worked with that you said, you know what, this is what it takes to be a founder. You know, the company went from X to Y, they were going to fail and they succeeded, or they did fail, like whatever that story is. But what we like to portray is what it takes to be a founder, because I think sometimes we see the world in this Instagram version that it's so amazing, and they forget what people have to go through to get to amazing. Is there a story that you could share on that?
Yes. So one of the companies that we invested in, it was in the fintech space, and the original CEO, he was, an accountant, very, very versed in the space, and he was driving the company into the ground, because he was paralyzed with this idea that everything had to be weighed and reconciled and everything had to be done safely. One of the things I've learned is that founders need to have vision and they need to surround themselves with people that say no. But the founder or the CEO needs to have vision. And when the CEO is the technical person, whether it's the CTO, whether it's a technical engineer or whatever the case is, I found that those companies don't do well. We had to step in into that company and we ended up making the COO the CEO. The COO was this, he didn't go to school, he didn't do anything that's pertaining to the fintech industry, but he worked some jobs while he was so in Canada we have a Spring Masters, that lawn care company that every high school kid does. So he did that and he did a few other sort of odd sales jobs along the way, learned and taught things to himself and just somehow, got into this business. I think he was friends with the original founder. But what I learned about him is that he is an excellent salesperson. He knows exactly how to sell something. Even if it's not ready yet, he can sell the idea, pre-sell the product, and then use that money to build out the features and then start when the contract is ready to go. And we've seen him do that a few times. And I thought to myself, okay, let's take a chance on him, because I think he would be the better CEO. And that company right now is where, I mean, they would have exited, they would have gone IPO in during this time, but the markets are so bad that they're actually just holding off until they go IPO when things get better. And that's been the best decision I've ever made when it comes to the operational factor of a business, because I found that the CEO needs to be the salesperson, right? They don't need to know how to run the business. They don't need to know how to do anything. They just need to be able to sell the idea to people, and that includes his employees, who are the ones who are experts at what they do. And ever since I've made that adjustment, I have not invested into any company so far where the CEO is not the salesperson. It doesn't matter if it's the most brilliant developer, most brilliant engineer that comes to me with this wonderful idea. If he's a CTO, wonderful. But if he's a CEO, for me, it's a no.
It's a good point. Everybody's selling, and you got to learn to sell if you're not. And if you can't, then you might not be the right role, because you can't just be the front runner without being part of the team and growing it. And if I was to break the business down and then share its two ways, you have the number one position, which is you have the front person, and that front person is the Bill Gates, it's the Steve Jobs, it's the one that has to be out interfacing and selling, selling, selling. And then you have the secondary, which is just as powerful in the business, and that person is focused on being the solutionist. They have to deliver the solution, and that's your Steve Wozniaks of the world. They're not in the limelight, but they're the ones that just tie it all together. And you need those two in order to operate. However, who owns those roles? They're the kind of the most crucial roles in a business if you want to build success. So to your point, you really have to find someone that has multifaceted, but has to be able to sell.
100%. And on that note, you're right. That's the person that doesn't get a lot of recognition. I really need to shout out my CTO for Investive. I mean, he doesn't get the love and the credit that he should. His name is Paul Iannuzzo. Quiet, very, mild mannered, and everything that you imagine that a developer would look like, if you don't know developers, is exactly what he looks like. And without him and without his problem solving and his execution, I don't know where Invested would be today. I mean, I'm the one that comes to him with all these, wild, far-fetched ideas. And, we'll have our 4-hour, development meetings together, and he'll say, nope, that's trivial. That's trivial. Yep, nope. And then, a week later, he's like, okay, well, can you look at this and tell me if this is good? And I don't have to do any of the technical stuff. And he's built fintech companies in the past before, and so without him and without somebody, as you said, the counterbalance to what I might be, the front runner, for example, we would have nothing. So I 100% agree with everything that you just said.
I love it. Well, we're giving a shout out to Paul then. He seems like a rock star and we're going to have to give a shout out to him. All right. We're going into the next favorite segment, which is called the 60-second rant. So this is how it operates and works. You're going to rant for 60 seconds on something you're passionate about, something you want the world to know about. And I'm going to time it at the five. When you have 5 seconds left, I will put my hand up, but that just means you got 5 seconds to finish up. I will rebuttal once. If I can, you might lose me. I don't know, but I'm going to try my best. So I'm going to say go, and you got 60 seconds. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
All right, you're on.
Okay, so one of the things that really grinds my gears when it comes to my business specifically is when I'm training salespeople. There's a mindset shift that I always have to grind out with these guys and just sort of help them understand is that I think sales is not about trying to build value. I think sales is about trying to create demand. And I think that I wish that more people would spend, and I wish that schools and universities would teach this concept that, you know, there has to be an understanding of human psychology, understanding that, you know, people are herd mentality, understanding that people don't want to be sold to, right? Like they want to feel like they're buying. It's like when you go into a store, right? And you know that you want to buy a pair of shoes, but when the attendant comes up to you and says, "Hey, can I help you with something?" Your automatic response is no. So it's not because that you don't want to, it's because you just don't want to feel like you're being manipulated.
I love it. So, well, that was your 60 seconds. I'm going to say that this is a great 60 second segment because sales, business development are one of the toughest areas to build and grow inside of a company. And really it comes down to commercialization. How do you commercialize what you're doing so that you can just hire bodies, they come in and they just process out this cookie cutter model that you built. It's exciting, awesome, and everybody wants it. And to all your points, it's very tough. There's a gentleman that we interviewed in the past. He was on a panel. His name's Jeff. He wrote a book on sales. I want to make an introduction because I can't think of his last name right at this very moment, but really cool, really awesome book. But my counter to this is that maybe when it comes to the sales side and the process and understanding, it goes back to the first thing you talked about, which was understanding the people, communicating, over-communicating, and being able to figure out what that is. Maybe there's something in there that helps you solve the sales side. And maybe Jeff can help too with his book and everything else he's doing. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the only way to solve the problem. I mean, you know, people, if you and I are having a conversation, if you spent most of the time talking, you're going to leave the conversation thinking, "Oh, that was a great conversation." But if I'm spending the most of the time talking, then you're probably looking at your watch as to when you need to go, right? So that just sort of goes to the point that if you as a salesperson or anything, and I think that we're all selling, does even if we're just having a conversation, we're selling something. And if you are able to let the other person talk about themselves and really explain everything about themselves, then you now have all the ammunition you need to either sell to them or to provide them some sort of value.
I think that's the golden nugget right there. That's the winning piece. It's all about getting them to open up and talk about themselves, ask questions that get them to start sharing. And that's when you know you've built that relationship and that's where it's going to kick off. I love it. All right, we're going to go into rapid fire questions. These are business rapid fire. So you pick one or the other, and this is coming from you as the investor. So you pick A or B. Cool? All right. Founder or co-founder?
Co-founder.
Unicorn or a four-year 10X exit?
Four-year 10-year exit.
Okay. Tech or CPG?
Tech.
NFTs or Web 3.0?
Neither.
AI or blockchain?
Blockchain.
First-time founder or a second, third-time founder?
First-time founder.
First money in or Series A?
First money in.
Angel or VC?
VC.
Board seat or observer?
Board seat.
Safe or convertible note?
Safe.
Lead or follow?
Follow.
Favorite part of investing?
Ooh, you didn't give me an option there. Meeting different people and their ideas.
Okay. Number of companies invested per year?
6.
Love it. Verticals of focus?
Fintech, technology, real estate, private equity, debt, or credit.
We're almost brothers. Love it. 2 qualities that you look for that a startup needs to stand out in order for you to take it to the next step?
Very unique value proposition in a blue ocean type of environment. And the other one I would say is just having the team to execute.
Okay.
Ideas are cheap. I think it's the execution that matters.
Again, big green button, red button, thumbs up, love it. What is the piece of advice you give founders 9 out of 10 times?
Listen to your team members. Listen to the feedback that they're giving you, because likely they're the ones that are dealing with the customers and not you.
Brilliant. Do you have a philosophy or rules that you stand behind?
For business? Yep. Never be the smartest person in the room.
What tech will define the world in the next 5 years?
That one's easy. AI, I think.
Who is your hero, mentor, and why?
This one's hard. I would say, damn, there's so many. I'm a big fan of Jordan Peterson. I like the way that he thinks and reasons. Forget all the other stuff, you know, whatever his views are, but I like the way that he looks at the world.
I do agree. I like a lot of his content. I've watched him talk, read his books. Yeah, you have to have 2 sides to every story or more.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that he brings all of that to the table when it can be counterintuitive to say some of the rhetoric that's out there, but I also think it's very supportive of how we have to question things, and it very well shared.
Yeah, I think it's about the questioning part, regardless of whether you agree with his opinions or not, or his conclusions, but the way that he arrives at those conclusions, I think that more people need to start doing.
Agreed. What is your biggest fear or phobia in the business startup ecosystem today?
I think my fear would be, or phobia would be, that people are not adapting to technology, especially in my industry. I think that's happening right now. Older generations who are running the family offices, you know, they're more resistant to new technology that's trying to replace their existing status quo. But I think that in a few years, in 5 years or so, that's going to all go away.
If you can change one thing about venture, what would it be?
A little more focus on founders and a little less focus on sort of control.
What was your worst investment?
An investment where I spent more time talking about control and a little less focus on the founder.
Perfect.
I lost, I would have to say, I lost the trust of the founder because I was more focused on trying to put my input in there because I thought that things were not going well. And maybe that's still a good thing to do, because as an investor, you have to protect your investment, but you have to enable and prop up your founder, because they're the ones who are steering the ship.
I like it. All right, we're going to do some personal questions now. Same as the business ones, pick one or the other, obviously from yourself. Book or movie?
Movie.
Superman or Batman?
Superman.
Fortune cookie or birthday cake?
Fortune cookie.
5 minutes with Bezos or Oprah?
Bezos.
Mountain or beach?
Beach.
Bike or run?
Bike.
Big Mac or Chicken McNuggets?
Nuggets.
Trophy or money?
Trophy.
Beer or wine?
Wine.
TED Talk or book reading?
TED Talk.
TikTok or Instagram?
Instagram. I don't do TikTok.
Facebook or LinkedIn?
LinkedIn.
Favorite movie and what character would you play?
The Gentleman. And Charlie Hunnam's character?
I know this movie.
Awesome movie.
It's like the British movie.
Yes.
Yeah. That I agree. That one was really good. Yeah.
Yeah.
All the suits, and it's kind of like a 007 style. Yeah. Great movie.
Yeah.
Great movie. Favorite book, and I think you mentioned this already.
Laws of Human Nature, or actually 48 Laws of Power, either of the two.
Brilliant. Favorite sports team?
Lakers.
Oof.
Yeah, it's a bad time right now.
fair enough.
Actually, that's a lie. My favorite sport team is whichever team LeBron is in right now.
Okay. Well, right now he's still in there. Who knows what happens next?
Yeah.
First brand that pops into your mind?
First brand,
like major brand that pops into your mind.
Oh, Microsoft.
Most famous person that pops in your mind?
Bezos.
What is the meaning of success to you?
Just being able to make your own decisions.
And last question, what is your superpower?
Being able to see through people.
I love it. I'll add one other thing. I think you also bring an element of calmness to all of your engagements. And I think that that allows for people to be able to interact in a different way with you. So I think that's also a good thing.
You know, that's probably the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me or can say to me. I am very quiet and I tend to stay reserved. So to recognize that, that's definitely much appreciated.
Of course. Well, I want to say that it was fantastic getting the opportunity to chat with you today. And the way we like to kind of end things off is that we want to give you the last word. So anything that you want to share to the startup community, to the investor community, I turn it over to you to share. Please also share how people can get a hold of you. And again, I want to thank you for all your time. It's been awesome. I think we went a little bit over time, but man, there was so much great content here. So you honestly, brilliant. Thank you for sharing. It was awesome.
I appreciate it. And thank you for having me. You can reach me through Investive or through LinkedIn. The easiest to reach on LinkedIn. I respond quite a lot. My priority going forward, given that, I have the family office and everything, but my priority going forward is to build out Investive, right? Because I have this vision in my mind of what I want this industry to be, a little more transparency, a little more access while preserving the necessary privacy. But really, there are no rules as to how this industry is, and I want to standardize a lot across it and give everybody the same sort of equal amount of access to capital and resources that a lot of the investment banking firms and et cetera have. And I think that starts with, providing value for investors and earning the trust of the investors. So any investor who, might be watching this, we don't charge with any investors, and that business model ensures that we have no motivations to misguide or to misalign ourselves with investors. And I think that's key. And I think that for those that are looking to raise capital or brokers and et cetera that use our system, the idea is that if we garner the trust of our investors, then we can take their input and build tech and build features that we know will not only provide you value, but also will be accepted by investors. And I think that gelling, I think, is what's missing in our industry. So that's the vision. We hope that it's the case in the next 3 to 4 years that we can get it there. And it'll take everybody to make that happen, because we can just build the infrastructure, but everybody else has to be the players in the pond.
Saad, thank you very much for sharing. Brilliant. Love where you're going. Love all the things that you've been doing. So again, thank you for all your time today. You've been a rock star. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Say, that was awesome. There was so much good stuff there that he shared, just how to approach a family office, the way to be focused, the way to learn more about their history. What have they invested? Where did they make their money? That's going to make a big difference when you're pitching. Metrics, just a lot of things that really take that history learning and figuring out how you can actually improve on it and make it better. And he did the same thing with the family office when they restructured it. I think that there's a lot of ways. He talked about even in his own business now on the privacy side, keeping things with anonymity, keeping things more secure, but anonymous. I think those really make a big difference in today's investment world. Gave his way of sharing, of course, on that side. And don't get stuck in the FOMO. Make sure you're doing your due diligence and your deep dives. And the other ones that were pretty big were transparency, talking to your team, sharing things that are going on, create accountability, get everybody to work that extra little harder because they see that there's a value for them in the future. That's the key to building these successful businesses. Thank you for joining us today. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please feel free to share with your friends, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and or please follow us on Spotify, Apple, and or Stitcher. Feel free to share an audio clip or video clip around the show, and we may include it in one of our future podcasts. You can find or follow us at marketing@openpeoplenetwork.com or at LinkedIn at Supporters Fund. Your support and comments are truly appreciated. Please visit us at Supporters Fund or for startup events or openpeoplenetwork.com. Thank you and have a fantastic day.